To start with this, these pictures of from a street artist. He's an English street artist, and his name is Banksy. We don't really know his first name or his last name, and that's part of the allure of this guy is his anonymity from his artwork that he's put up really all over the world. And there's a couple things that are amazing about it. One is for someone to be able to do the amount of work that this guy has done in the places he is, it's amazing that he's been able to remain anonymous. Nobody knows his identity. This was a couple of years ago. He was in New York, and you know, there's been a move to kind of make some of his work disappear. So he's got this rat that appears in a lot of his different, I'm not quite sure what the meaning of it is, in some of his different work. But so this, I think, is on a 7-story apartment building. And how in the world would you do something like this and not have people know that you were doing it? I don't know. And it's pretty, you know, he's got a guy painted on the scaffolding rolling out the work that he's put, and he's got the rat with the scissors saying, no, this is going to stay here. Even though we don't, see, here's the thing that's interesting about this guy. Even though we don't know who he is and he wants to protect his anonymity, you can actually learn a lot about this guy from his art, because he says something about the world and what he thinks, and some of his work is political. A couple of years ago, he spent some time in Israel and in the West Bank, Gaza Strip area, and so he's got a IDF Israeli soldier here, and he's got the Palestinian child taking a flower and sticking it up the barrel of the guy's gun, and Israel worked hard to erect this barrier for protection between themselves and the Palestinians, and you know, he has this thing about, you know, walls and barriers, that, you know, curiosity won't, just because you put walls up, won't keep people apart. In fact, you shouldn't always keep people apart. Curiosity always draw people together. So his work has this kind of this political slant to it too. You know, protesting has been a big thing over the last several weeks here in the news, and this is one of his original works that's really famous. And so he's, you know, rather than a Molotov cocktail, you want to protest, throw flowers instead. It's really political also, global warming stuff, artwork that he's done about privacy in New York. Does New York really have a heart? You know, so his art's kind of, you know, it's funny, it's satirical, it's got a political message to it. And so even though we don't know who this guy is, his artwork says something about who he is and what he thinks about the world. It's interesting because you might just think he's like a street thug, or what you might say his work is graffiti. But he has sold a number of his works at auction, and quite a few of them for over $100,000. In 2007, The Space Girl and a Bird sold for more than $500,000. He's been able to take his artwork into like the National Museum of Art and put it up, and it remained up there for 2.5 days before they figured that out. It didn't really belong in there. He's gone in and he's changed artwork, like in the Louvre. He's gone in and put his own rendering of the Mona Lisa up over the original Mona Lisa. So he's done some pretty amazing things. It's amazing with all these things he's done, all the places he's been, the places where he's placed his stuff so prominently that we really don't have an idea about who he is. And here's the thing. See, he wants it that way. He doesn't want people to know his real identity. See, and I want to tell you about another kind of artist who, in very sharp contrast to Banksy, has a really provocative message about the world and about life. But unlike Banksy, this artist wants you to know exactly who he is, and wants to use his art to draw people to himself. And so this is a panorama that a friend of mine took on top of Carson Pass last year, and it was a self-portrait. He put this on his tripod, and picture of him looking up, and you can kind of see up there on the left-hand side of the screen the beginning of the Milky Way rising up to his left when he was camping out there. And so the artist I'm going to spend some time talking about tonight is God and his handiwork. We're starting a new series in the book of Genesis, and I'm going to take an enormous chunk of the book of Genesis today. I'm going to do all of one verse for you, it sounds sort of funny to say that, but you know what, Genesis 1:1, just that beginning where it says, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." When you look online, for instance, and you look at like messages that people have preached, among the single most talked about topic is this one verse. And there's so many different angles that you can go at and to try and get your mind around or think about what is all entailed just in that one verse. And so I'm going to spend a little bit of time today just kicking off our series, just working through this one verse and just a couple of the implications about it. See, the psalmist, I think, was absolutely correct when he said, the heavens, they declare the glory of God. And the skies, they proclaim the work of this almighty God's hands in such a profound way. And I hope that even just going through this tonight, that you might be, next time you go out and you look up into the heavens, that you'll have sort of a different perspective on the grandeur, and you'll be able to stand in awe in a whole new way about our Creator. And so I want to take you on just a little journey through the universe. And of course, a great place to start is with our own planet Earth. And Earth astronomically, in terms of talking about other stars and planets, really isn't that big. The circumference around it is 24,000 miles. So, what's the distance between New York and L.A. Or San Francisco is like roughly 3,000 miles, a little under that. So you'd make that trip 8 times to get sort of that circumference if you want to travel all the way around the world, which isn't a big deal. You think about flying, I've got some friends here tonight that are just back from Paris visiting their daughter. And, Paris is a good distance around the world, and you can do that in a day. A day? Yeah? Flying a little more than a day? I don't know. It depends on... but like the distance from Hawaii to London, say, is 7,000 miles. So you could do that trip back and forth, Hawaii to London, 3 times. And you still, that wouldn't stretch you the whole circumference of the Earth. So the Earth is a big place. But here's the thing about the Earth that's really amazing, especially compared to the rest of what we see in the rest of the world and the universe. It teems with life from top to bottom, to the depths of the ocean. I mean, the depths, more than a mile down. I lived in Monterey, and you go to the aquarium, and you see the submarine canyon there that drops off in a quarter of a mile out off Moss Landing, a mile deep. And it teems with life down that far in the ocean, all the way up into the air. It's incredible, the life that this place sustains and produces. Whether you're in the North Pole with penguins, or whether where they're the hottest regions of the Earth, there is life, and it supports life everywhere. It's absolutely incredible. But like I say, in comparison to the rest of the world, the rest of astronomy, it's as marvelous as it is, it's not that big. Neil Armstrong, who was the first person to step foot on the moon, he said this coming back. He says, "I remember on a trip home from Apollo 11, it suddenly struck me that tiny pea, pretty and blue, was Earth. I put up my thumb, and I shut one eye, and my thumb blotted out the planet Earth. I didn't feel like a giant. I felt very, very small." And I was thinking about this afternoon, that Armstrong, among all people who could brag about his accomplishments and his successes in the world, who could think himself something, and rightly so, there's moments where you have this picture of the scope of what you're dealing with, and it humbles you greatly. In 1990, Voyager sent out it turned around and looked back towards the Milky Way, and I couldn't tell you how far out this was, but this is a 6-shot panorama, and we knew where to look for the planet Earth in that band of stars there. And so in that 6-panel panorama that they put together, you can see in the top left-hand corner there, that little blue light there, and that's the planet Earth looking back from Voyager. And so I said six. It's 60 images, sorry, in 1990. And this is where Carl Sagan coined that phrase, that pale blue dot. And this is what he said. And remember, Sagan is not, he's not a Christian. He's not a theist. This is what he said. "It's been said that astronomy is humbling, and I might add a character-building experience. To my mind, there is perhaps no better demonstration of the folly of human conceit than this distant image of our tiny world. To me, it underscores that our responsibility to deal more kindly and compassionately with one another, to preserve and cherish that pale blue dot, the only home we've ever known. Now, isn't it interesting? Here's someone who's not a Christian, doesn't believe that God, orchestrated this thing that is our home, and yet he's even moved to talk about the world and life in moral terms. That's how humbled he is thinking about this. Pretty profound, isn't it? One of the things I got to confess right off the bat to you guys is on Sunday mornings, I always sort of come up here and there's this sense of trepidation I have because I feel like I've studied and put a lot of work into my message, and I want to do a good job, and I'm talking about God, I'm talking about important stuff, and I want to do a good job delivering it. But at the same time, there's at least I feel like, my life to this point's been dedicated to studying the Bible and talking about theology and faith, and I feel like I know a good amount about history and culture, and so I feel I at least feel like it's in the realm of something I should be talking about. See, I'm talking about astronomy, and I'm talking about biology, and I'll be honest with you, I have no business being a spokesperson up here, which my high school teachers would love to point out to you via my grades, that I have no business talking about this stuff. The average Sunday, Dan and I were talking about this, if it's a message that we're really comfortable with, that's really in our wheelhouse, we can get away with spending 8 to 10 hours sort of in preparation for a message. But the average is more like 15 to 25. I spent at least, in the last 10 days, I've spent at least 20 hours just rereading stuff to be able to do this. And these concepts are so foreign to me that I'll show you the slide here in just a minute. You ever have that moment in a conversation with somebody and they'll say something and you go, what? Because you're not sure you heard the person correctly, or they say something astounding and you're like, what? That can't be right. Can you see? And you need them to repeat it to you because it's hard to believe. See, even tonight I had to go back and look at this number again because it doesn't make any sense to me, and I have no way of putting it in perspective when I think about numbers of things. And I just want to show you just a little bit about when you look at the Milky Way, what are we actually looking at? It's just one of hundreds of billions of galaxies in the known universe that we're able to look out on. I'd read this number and I go, that can't be right, and I'd resource it. I'd look somewhere else for it. And you know what? I'm using the lowest threshold number that you'll find. Most people put the number between 130 and 170, some as high as 200. It's unbelievable the vastness of the universe. Well, our own galaxy that we have here, the Milky Way, our galaxy alone consists of at least, this is just the Milky Way band of our galaxy, at least 100 billion stars. Now, how vast is it? How big and wide is it? If you traveled at the speed of light, and this again, this shows you how inept I am dealing with these numbers. I wondered, well, what's that MPS thing? I'm thinking that's 186,000 miles per hour. I didn't realize, I'm like, well, that must be a typo, that S. I didn't realize that's 186 million miles per second. It would take you 100,000 years. This is not the universe, this is our spiral galaxy. That's how enormous it is. If you want to do the job, God says he knows the names of all the stars, and whether that's just hyperbole or not, I don't know, but let's just say you wanted to give them all name. If you would count the stars in the Milky Way, one star per second, it would take you 2,500 years just to count them all. See, when you start looking at this stuff and you look at these numbers, it's astounding. And see, God makes this claim that he's the maker, creator, sustainer of all that grandeur. I was giving you a picture of how big the earth is, and a lot of people understand this. Look, in comparison to the rest of the, well, just in our own solar system, the earth is tiny. And when you look at it in comparison to the sun, it really is. It's just a dot. See, if you drilled a hole through the earth, the diameter, right, from one side to the other, the longest distance, it would be almost 8,000 miles. How much bigger is the sun than that? The sun is 864,000 miles drilling a hole straight through it. That's how big. So if the earth, you think the earth is a big place. Let's say you think the earth is a small place. The sun's absolutely enormous. If you melted down in liquid form the earth and you poured it into the to meet the volume of what's in the sun, it would take you 1.3 million Earths to fill up the sun. That's how big the sun is. Here's another way to think about this. Mike, will you stand up for a minute? Hold up my golf ball. Okay, so another way to think about this is if the earth is represented by the golf ball, which Mike can put in his hand. You've never been able to do that before. Hold the whole thing in. Okay, now hold the tape measure. Okay. So the earth compared to the sun, 15 feet would be the size of the circumference around in comparison to the golf ball to get the size of how big the sun is in comparison. Another way to think about this, thanks Mike, another way to think about this is to kind of get your mind around this, if these numbers don't make any sense to you, is to take a basketball. And if a basketball was represented and you wanted to keep the size comparison consistent, so this morning I came with my son and I measured from up here to the back of the building. You know, I wanted to see how far back it was to get the measurement of how big the sun would be in comparison. And the very back row was 80 feet from right here. And you'd have to go out another 27 feet. 107 feet in comparison is how much bigger, you know, distance-wise across in comparison to a basketball the sun is. It's absolutely enormous compared to the sun. But the sun doesn't even scratch the surface in the size of the universe and even just our own solar system of what God has made. Take Betelgeuse, for example. It's 640 light years away, just a short distance. It wouldn't take you that long in a jumbo jet, I'm sure. Betelgeuse, if you look out on the western sky, it's that the top left-hand corner of the constellation Orion. Betelgeuse, if you're familiar with other stars in the galaxy, you know, Antares and Regal and stuff like that, you can see Betelgeuse is enormous. And see the smallest dot on there? That's represented by our sun. That's how much bigger Betelgeuse is than our own sun. Another way to think about this is Betelgeuse in comparison to Earth. So this last year, my mom took me on a trip up to Alaska. And one of the cool things I got to do was I got to go on what's billed as the highest zip line in the world. And it's actually 2 feet higher than the Empire State Building. And it's an incredible ride. You do it in 90 seconds. You go over 60 miles an hour to get down to the ground. It's just absolutely incredible. So if you want to think about it in comparison, how big is the Earth compared to like the Empire State Building, you'd have to stack 6 Empire State Buildings on top of them. And the golf ball would represent the Earth on the sidewalk down below it. The diameter of it is about 700 times the size of the sun. It's 600 million miles drilled straight through. Betelgeuse emits 7,500 times as much energy as the sun. And there's other stars. That's mild compared to Betelgeuse in terms of the energy it emits. That's mild compared to some of the other sun-like stars that are in the galaxy that can emit as much as 100,000 times as much energy as our own sun. Staggering. One last way to think about this. Do you remember when you were young and you could look at like the, you know, in your astronomy books and you saw like the sun and the planets revolving around it, and you could see sort of the orbit of the Earth around the sun. It's a big circle. Betelgeuse is twice the size of the orbit of the Earth. around the sun. It's enormous. You know, it's not only in terms of looking out, not only are these numbers just staggering to me, I don't know if they are to you or not, but how big the scale of what we're talking about is overwhelming to me. It's also beautiful. And this picture is on the Hubble site. And the reason I like this is this is, this is Galaxy NGC 4710. It's located 65 million light years away. And the reason I like this picture, and I put it up here for you, is because unlike a lot of other astronomy pictures you see, this wasn't tampered with at all. This is the natural light looking out 65 million light years away. And it's one of the few pancake spiral-shaped galaxies that are out there. Another one looking back sort of at the Milky Way, this is a composite from the Spitzer Space Telescope and the Chandra X-ray Observatory, along with the Hubble. And the reason you get those red colors in there is because it's the gases that have been heated up by the sun. And that's why you get the magnificent color, which is what the X-ray picks up in there. The thing I told First Service is this is really neat. You know, you don't have to go out into the Milky Way to be able to see these kind of red gases. You come by the church on any given day when Dan goes and has Chinese food, you can go in his office and you can see the same kind of red gaseous state, probably even more poisonous than what you'd get out there. Among the most classic pictures ever taken by the Hubble is this one in 1995. And ironically, NASA called it the Pillars of Creation. It's this star-forming region in the Eagle Nebulous, and it's 6,500 light years from Earth. In 2007, you go to Hubble's site and you can see the reconstituted picture that they did last year of this, and the detail, the high-res picture of it, JPEG of it, it's astonishing in its beauty. But here's in reading about this, this is what I just can't even fathom this. The tower's pillars, from top to bottom, are about 5 light years in distance between the top of those clouds and the bottom. Just staggering to me when you look out and you see not only just the enormity of God's claim that He made all of this stuff and held it all together. It doesn't just collapse back in on itself because of gravity. Incredible. And it's beautiful too. One of the questions a lot of people have posed in the last number of years is this idea that science and the Bible, or this idea that science and an idea that someone actually created this are incompatible. And in the really neat movie Contact, which wrestles with, in large part, with this whole idea, Jodie Foster, who's the scientist, the naturalist, her antagonist in the story is the theologian played by Matthew McConaughey. And there's this great scene, and I don't have time to play it all, but she asks this very question.
Come on, it's like you're saying that science killed God. What if science simply revealed that He never existed in the first place?
Sort of the question, isn't it, is what if science really, what it does is frees us up from this ancient idea that people used to cling to? In olden times when we didn't really understand the world, and naturalism now explains all of these wonders. So we don't need to hold on to those old myths, this idea that there's some intelligent person behind all of this. In Christmas Day in the Wall Street Journal, Eric Metaxas had a great article talking about this very idea that actually, from his perspective, the evidence actually says that science is ever increasing in its ability to make the case for something intelligent behind this masterpiece of not only the earth, but the world and the life that we've come to know and understand and can observe. He says, today there are more than 200 known parameters necessary for a planet to support life. Every single one of them, which must be perfectly met, or the whole thing falls apart. Without a massive, and he gives several examples in here, he says, without a massive planet like Jupiter nearby, whose gravity will draw away asteroids, 1,000 times as many would hit Earth's surface. That would sort of make it less inhabitable, I would imagine. The odds against life in the universe are simply astonishing. Yet here we are, not only existing, but talking about existing. He's saying, you know, this, not only are we this biological miracle, but we have this ability to comprehend and ask questions and dialogue. We can philosophize about how amazing this is. He says, just the fact that we can do that's a miracle. Yet here we are, not only existing, but talking about existing. What can account for this? Can every one of those parameters have been perfect by accident? And he asked the 50-cent question, at what point is it fair to admit that science suggests that we can't be the result of random forces? Naturalism says nothing plus pure chance equals everything. That's the equation for naturalism. And he says, at what point can we say that's totally illogical? Doesn't assuming that an intelligence created these perfect conditions require far less faith than believing that life-sustaining Earth just happened to beat the inconceivable odds to come into being? People will say that if you believe that the Earth and life was created by a God, people will say you're making an enormous leap of faith. And science, interestingly, is sort of turning that on its head and saying, you know what, actually science makes more sense to say that we got here on purpose by someone that knew what they were doing. And the people that are taking a leap of faith are the people that are ignoring that evidence and going the other direction to say it just so happened by random, undirected chance. See, even just from astronomy, we can see the how ludicrous this is. Outstanding book that goes through many of these things is The Case for a Creator, Lee Strobel's book. I think it's his best book that he's put out. And he just points out some really simple facts. He says, it's got to be the right kind of galaxy, and we can see all these galaxies by looking out into the rest of the universe. And see, it's got to be a spiral galaxy, and the problem with this is that less than 5%, in fact, the more detail that we can look into these different galaxies, we're finding out that not only is the number closer, it's really even smaller. The number continues to shrink as we're getting more and more evidence of these galaxies and how they're laid out. And that's one of the things that's so unique about our own galaxy. It's got to be not only the right kind of galaxy, but you've got to be in the right arm within that spiral, and the orbit has to be circular. And the thing that we're finding out is more than 90% of planets that orbit around other suns and other galaxies don't, because their loop is elliptical as opposed to circular. That's part of why you go too far out away from the sun, for instance, and why other planets are more hostile. See, looking at all these things, Hugh Ross, who's an astronomer, written a number of books about these sorts of things, he says, look, much less than one chance in a million trillionth exists that even one such planet would occur anywhere in the universe. See, it's not only having to be in the right kind of galaxy, but you've even got to have within the right orbit of the right arm of that spiral galaxy, you've got to have the right kind of sun. And Earth has this great margin of error. It's really amazing, because we could actually be 2% further or 2% closer, and life could actually still survive on Earth. But see, one of the big problems is Earth is a really relatively stable energy giver, and most are way too volatile. So even if you were the right distance, the reality is most other energy sources in the universe are way too volatile to be able to emit a constant, steady stream of energy that could make life possible. Enzo Panisi, he's a Nobel laureate, an American astronomer, and doctor of other natural sciences, he says, astronomy leads us to a universe with a very delicate balance needed to provide exactly the conditions required to permit life, one which has an underlying, one might say, supernatural plan. Back to that Wall Street Journal article, Metaxas says, astrophysicists now know that the values of the four fundamental forces, gravity, the electromagnetic force, and the strong and weak nuclear forces were determined less than 1/1,000,000th of a second after the Big Bang. I mean, just think about, you know, the numbers that we're talking about. After alter any one value, and the universe could not exist. For instance, if the ratio between the nuclear strong force and the electromagnetic force had been off by the tiniest fraction, by even one part in a big number, then no stars could have ever formed at all. Multiply that single parameter by all the other necessary conditions, and the odds against the universe existing are heart-stoppingly astronomical. That the notion that it all just happened defies common sense. It'd be like tossing a coin and having it come up heads quintillion times in a row. Fred Hoyle, who's one of my favorite astronomers because of those glasses he's wearing, are like the coolest things I've seen all week. I love those things. I picked an old picture of him on purpose just because I like those glasses. Fred Hoyle, he looks like a smart guy, doesn't he? The astronomer who coined the term Big Bang said that his atheism was greatly shaken at these developments. He later wrote that a common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect, I love that term, has monkeyed with the physics as well as the chemistry and biology. The numbers one calculates from the facts seem to me so overwhelming as to put this conclusion almost beyond question. I could have put up here 40 different quotes from people in the natural sciences that all essentially say the same thing. Even Discovery Magazine, which is no friend to the idea that somehow there was an intelligent designer behind all this. I love this. Discovery Magazine, in a recent article, had Martin Rees, who's British, their royal astronomer, who's on their trustee of their astronomy board, says, "The universe is unlikely. It's very unlikely. Deeply, shockingly unlikely. It's quite fantastic." See, I think that the reality is the more you look at the grandeur of the universe, and the more you come to see how big and enormous it is, you can't help but come to this conclusion that the Earth stands in amazing contrast to everything else that we see out there. And if what the Bible tells us is true, see, it's God's handiwork. Not only the universe and all the galaxies, but particularly, like Sagan says, this tiny blue dot in the midst of all of it. And you can't help but stand in awe of it. The interesting thing, though, is, see, I think that like Sagan said, you know, he had that humbling experience that even astronomy, as you look out, can testify, I think, of the grandeur of God. The same thing can be true if you look inside your own human biology and microbiology, what it tells us about how magnificent and amazingly complex we are as a creation. Francis Crick, who is one of the guys who discovered, the two guys who discovered the coding of DNA, when he looks inside, this is what he says about looking small now. So that's the macro look. Here's the micro look. He says, "An honest man, armed with all the knowledge available to us now, could only state that in some sense, the origins of life appears at the moment to be almost a miracle. So many are the conditions which would have had to have been satisfied to get it all going." Michael Behe, in his outstanding book, Darwin's Black Box, gives a number of outstanding illustrations of the microbiology involved in our human bodies. It's incredible. This is I was talking to one of the doctors after church in our after church this morning, who was talking to me about this, the clotting cascade, and all these different steps that have to happen in order for your body, when you cut yourself, for your blood to clot. And it's amazing, he was saying, that we don't have more hemophiliacs, because any one of those steps doesn't exist or is out of place your blood won't clot. And the interesting thing he told me, which I hadn't thought about, is he said, this really is a cascade and a cascade of events that has to happen in a certain time, in a certain way, at a certain speed. And he says, he gave me this illustration of if you turn water on and you think about the flow of water out of a faucet, you know, like if you're doing dishes and you turn on the water too hard and the water will hit the pan and splash out, or if you don't have enough pressure, it's not helpful to do the dishes. He says, it's got to be turned on to just the right flow in order to make the job possible. He says that flow is the exact same thing. You speed up any one of the processes in this, and that's what you'll end up with, blood clotting. He says, just the fact that our blood works as well as it does in our bodies for carrying blood cells around, he says, it's astonishing that it works as well as it does in so many of us. In Darwin's Black Box, he also has this great illustration of bacterial flagellum. And it's this, with electron microscopes, we can look at it, and it's this tiny little motor delivers via proteins, the structure of it built by proteins, bacteria to different places, bacterium in your body when you need it in different places. And this motor is apparently incredibly complex. It's got 40 different parts to it, and you take away any one of those 40 parts built by the proteins, and it ceases to work. The interesting thing about this is it will reach speeds of 10,000 RPMs. What you think about a sports car and how amazing a sports car is that it can, you know, rev as high as it can, RPM as high as it can. This thing will get to 10,000 RPM spinning in less than a second, stop in less than a second, and spin the other direction in less than a second. And even though we can see this motor, the doctor was telling me we haven't figured out how to be able to build one. So we understand that what its job is and how it works, but we don't have any clue as to how to make it work. A simpler illustration of all of this is something that you can all appreciate just by looking at somebody else or looking in the mirror, is the complexity of your own human eye. This great eye doctor has this blog about this. He says, although accounting for just 1/4,000th of an adult's weight, it's the medium which processes some 80% of the information received by its owner from the outside world. The tiny retina contains 130 million rod-shaped cells, which detect light instantaneously and transmit impulses to the visual cortex of the brain by means of some 1 million nerve fibers, while nearly 6 million cone-shaped cells do the same thing, but respond specifically to color variations. The eyes can handle 500,000 messages simultaneously and are kept clear by ducts producing just the right amount of fluid, which the lids can clean both eyes simultaneously in 1/5,000th of a second. You know, if you read Darwin's Origins, it's interesting because even Darwin in places is honest about this idea of how far-fetched it is that just by chance some of the different, not only a variety of species, but even looking at our human biology, was hard for him to grasp. And he has moments of honesty in there, and there's a couple of them. And one of them is talking about the human eye. And he didn't have the ability to comprehend all that we do today. Darwin said, to suppose that the eye, with all its immutable contrivances for adjusting to the focus of different distances, for admitting different amounts of light, and for the correction of spherical and chromatic aberration, could have been formed by natural selection seems, I freely confess, absurd in the highest sense. See, even Darwin had these moments where he recognized, you know what, it's just really hard to believe that just by pure blind chance stuff like this developed. Do you guys remember we did this series a couple of months ago of working through the book of Proverbs? And Proverbs claims to be the book of wisdom, which is how do you look and render and understand the world from God's perspective? How do you make sense of it from God's perspective? How are you able to not only make choices in line with how God made us to live, but how do you rightly give credit to God for who he is and what he's done? And the psalmist in Psalm 139 says this so well, because I think that there's a sense in which this psalmist is far wiser than most university professors today, because he acknowledges when he looks at all of this stuff, he says, I praise you because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. And I know that full well. See, the Bible says if you want to be a wise person, you can make a leap of faith and logic to say, life just happened. And you can fill in the blank with whatever you want, just by random chance. Or you can say, ascribe to God what He rightly deserves. By recognizing just what that one verse says, in the beginning, God created all the grandeur and all the things that we awe and marvel at, and that He's responsible for that. And I think the Scripture lays out this option for us where we can either ascribe to God what's due Him, or we can rob it of that and ascribe it to something nonsensical. And the choice is ours. And see, this is what the Scripture, I think, helps us do. It helps us render our way through the world in a wise way by seeing the world and recognizing it for what it is. I tell you, working through this stuff, one of the things that I realized 2 days ago is as pastor, see, I want to, at the end of a message, I want to come up here and I want to say to you, here's what the Bible says. And here's what you ought to do in your life, or here's what you ought to consider doing in your life, or making a part of your life, right? Or making adjustments in your life. And you know what I sort of recognized is this study is such a humbling experience for me to recognize the grandeur of God. I hope that in some sense, as we work through this stuff today, that just in your own, for a couple of minutes here, you had the opportunity to be humbled by thinking about the grandeur and awe and power and majesty of God. And if that's true, and in some sense you do have this humbling experience when you consider God and who He is and what He's made, you might ask yourself, what would a genuine, humble response to God look like in your own life? And how do you demonstrate it? See, and I'm hesitant because I don't know, because God made each one of us different. And I don't know if for some of you that means laying flat out on the ground before God for an hour, silently just in awe and giving Him great thanks for the amazing God and Creator He is. I don't know if humility looks like when we sing our song tonight. Do you remember that song that we sang at the beginning of the service, Undignified? You weren't here this morning, sorry. This morning they sang the song Undignified. It's a David Crowder song that talks about it was referring back to Scripture about King David, when he came back, and he's marching back into town, and he's giving God glory for what the victories that God has won, and he disrobes himself down to his linen, you know, just little covering. And his wife says, you're acting undignified. That's no way for a king to act. And David said, I'll become even more undignified before God, because the praise and honor that's due him, I have no problem dancing before God. You know, when I think about that, and we sung that this morning, I think about how sedated my own life is. I don't lay down on prostrate before God. I don't even get on my knees very often before God. It's hard for me to raise my hands in awe and thanks to God for how great He is as an expression of praise, because I feel uncomfortable doing that. And I don't like singing, one, because my voice sucks, and you guys would be grateful that I don't sing loud. But here's the thing. I'm not sure when we sing, if I'm worried about what you think, I'm not really singing to God, am I? And see, I wonder if humility looks like you're willing to lay your own pride aside and sing at the top of your own voice. I don't know what humility means for you to lay aside your pride and recognize God for who He is. But if you're genuinely moved by the grandeur and the power of God, it ought to show up somewhere in your life, I think. The other thing is, when you consider the intricacies of life and the fine-tuning of the universe, see, science, I think it does seem to confirm this existence of an intelligent designer, someone who really did monkey with the physics and the biology to make it all work. And so what it does is when you look at this stuff, from way out to way in, I think what it does is it points to a reality that there really is a God. If you think of yourself it being in conjunction within God's creation, the sun, the moon, the stars, the universe, the magnificent thing, the teeming ball of blue that is our planet Earth, what does it look like for you in your own life to point to the majesty of God? If you're part of creation and creation displays and speaks forth the glory of God, what does that look like in your own life for you to point toward the magnificence of God and the grandeur of God? I don't know. See, just going back to the very beginning, and I'll close with this. Unlike Banksy, God tells us exactly why he did all this. Paul, who wrote a big part of our New Testament, in Acts, he's talking to an audience who wondered about this, and he says, the God who made the world and everything in it, and this is a great passage, this whole chapter is amazing, but the God who made the world and everything in it, skip down to verse 27, did this so that people, they would seek him, perhaps reach out and find him. God put all this on display, the magnificence of who he is and his power. Because unlike Banksy, he wants to be known. And in a very general way, creation, the universe, the stars, the sun, the moon, the skies, and you and I, we display in a general sense the glory of God. But it's interesting because if you ever heard the argument, people go, well, how come God doesn't just rip the sky apart and yell down, hey, it's me, I'm here, this is what it's all about. See, but in a very specific sense, God has done just that. He tells us exactly who he is, exactly what he's like. That's why Hebrews tells us that the Son, he's the radiance of the glory of God. He's the exact representation of his glory. You ever wonder, you want to know what God is like? God puts it on full display out there and through his Son. The grandeur of his love, his mercy, his justice, it's all on display. His power over the elements and is demonstrated in his miracles. It's all in full display right there in front of us in the person of Jesus Christ. Colossians tells us the same thing. The Son, he's the image of the invisible God. See, all of this is just to say it doesn't matter if you're a Buddhist, it doesn't matter if you're a Muslim, and naturalism is its own religion because it answers the same philosophical questions that everybody in the world wonders about. We all want to navigate the world. We all ask these same questions. How did we get here? Why is there pain and suffering in the world? What part does that play in the equation of life? Am I getting up in the morning because does my life mean anything? Is there any sort of purpose to it? And everybody wants to know, is this it? And a naturalist would say, this is it. See, everybody answers these questions and uses them to guide them through their life. And if you want to understand the rest of Genesis and what it tells us about God and about us, you've got to get the beginning of the story right. You can't just say this happened by random chance. You have to understand that if you want to understand the rest of the plot, you've got to get this right, that it really is serious and it really is true when God says, in the beginning, God created. See, he was the first cause, and he is the person who created and sustains the whole thing. I hope that next time you're outside that you'll have the opportunity to say, the heavens, they declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the works of his hand. Psalm 139, they speak forth who he is. And I hope that your lives will do the same thing that the stars do, that you'll speak forth about the glory and grandeur of God and the way you choose to live this week. God bless you guys and have a great week. Thanks for coming. Hope that you enjoyed this. It was a grand challenge for me to put it together. If our ushers will come forward, we're going to continue our worship tonight with our offering. Thanks for coming, guys.